Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward. Together, that's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eyes Look at This Week in the Capitol. J.R., things are heating up. But let's start with, a few months ago, 56 judges, including two former Supreme Court justices, petitioned the court for a rule on recusals. Mm-hmm. And this would change the rule that was adopted in 2010. What they wanted, let's just talk about the Supreme Court. If someone gave $20,000 a year campaign, and you would have to recuse yourself as a Supreme Court justice, well, actually, you could give a maximum of $20,000. But if they gave $10,000 or more, you would have to automatically get off. So the Supreme Court just this week considered that, and 2-5-2 votes. Number one, we're not going to have a hearing on it. Mm-hmm. Number two, we're not going to adopt the rule. So I know I haven't given you a chance to comment, but let's listen to about 2 minutes of that back and forth. Listen for Chief Justice Rogenczak asking Justice Ann Wallace Bradley for examples. It's a key part. Let's hear that right now.
We cannot consider the petition further because to do so would violate the oath that each of us took when we undertook our office. The petition asks us to disregard that oath, in my mind. It asks us to infringe the First Amendment rights of the people of Wisconsin who wish to participate in judicial elections without being penalized for exercising their free speech rights. I practiced law for over 16 years. I've served at every level of the judiciary, and I know that the judges and justices in this state strive every day to fulfill that oath, to render impartial justice, setting aside their own personal feelings about cases and the people involved in those cases, to render decisions in accordance with the law. And if any judge fails to do so, if a judge does not act with impartiality and integrity, that judge will answer to the people of Wisconsin on their election day.
The rules have been changed so that campaign committees can actively solicit, judges' campaign committees can actively solicit litigants who currently have cases pending before the court. They can solicit money contributions from them. So their campaign committees can say, oh, Smith versus Jones is on the docket for a month from now. Let's see if Smith can contribute.
Can you think of any instance where some, I mean, you're insinuating that happens, Anne.
No, but I am saying,
where that has happened.
One instance, Anne. One instance.
Kind of an interesting
Annette,
approach.
See, I don't think you realize that's what you adopted in 2010.
And has that ever happened? You say this as though it's a fact.
You know,
fact.
I smile.
Amazing.
Because the very idea is aghast, causes you to be aghast. But that's, read the words, that's what you adopted in 2010. You don't even know it.
Okay, JR, we went right into the video. No surprises in the 5-2 votes. We're not going to have a hearing. We're not going to adopt this rule.
No, because if you look at the makeup of the court, for conservatives, this is like a no-brainer. I mean, to them, you should not be doing this. For good government groups who are not the majority or don't have a majority audience with the Supreme Court, this is something I think needs to be done for the integrity of the court. But for conservatives, why? I mean, if you go back to 2010, right, they already established a rule base that says, if you are a justice or a judge, it's up to you. It's mm-hmm. your judgment.
Yes.
What's changed since 2010?
Recusals when I see it. Excuse me.
Two justices have left and been replaced by arguably more conservative justices. So nothing's changed. One, Crooks, who supported changing the rules to have a recusal standard. One, Prosser, who did not. So there's been no dynamic change, sea change with the court, with the makeup, that would say, okay, this is actually going to fly this time. So no surprise.
Okay, 3 hours after the vote, you had three Assembly Democrats who are lawyers come into the Capitol press room. Dana Walks out of Eau Claire, Chris Taylor out of Madison, and Gary Hebel, just north east mm-hmm. of Madison. And Hebel said, This is especially appalling because Justice Gableman, who, by the way, is up next year, mm-hmm. received this is what Hebel said. This is not me saying this. Received $150,000 in free legal advice to defend him against the ethics charges from Michael Best and Friedrich, and has not recused himself from any case involving Michael Best and Friedrich. So how big of a problem, potentially, does Gableman have when he's up next year?
Oh, I mean, they could probably use it as a kind of an ad against him of some sort. But, you know, Justice Abramson, quite frankly, in her 2009 reelection, had questions about attorneys who had been before her in the court during her campaign. She didn't hurt her election.
Yeah.
So the court has had a crisis of confidence with the public of the last 6-7 years, maybe longer than that, with these various 10 years flare-ups over. Kind of started with the Ziegler election in 2007, where first time I saw big money come in, and then she got dinged with this ethics complaint over sitting on cases that she was Washington County judge involving businesses in the community, which her family had an interest. Of course, the argument was in Washington County, she had lots of ties, so you couldn't avoid those. 2008, with the Gableman race, with the complaint over the ad he ran against Lewis Butler.
Which is, correct me if I'm wrong, that is still not been resolved.
It just basically went away because they couldn't resolve it. And that's when you started to see Abramson with the questions about the donations. The big money started coming in after that, and that's the point. And then 2011 with Prosser and the de facto referendum on Act 10, it became the explosion of money with the WMCs of the world getting involved heavily, realtors, and then what do you do? And the justices have said clearly, it is up to us to decide when to step off a case, and that's not going to change. As long as you have a conservative majority in this court, it's not going to change.
And we didn't see any big money get involved because Justice Ziegler, who was just reelected for a new 10-year term, was unopposed.
Yeah.
But we saw there in that clip, the animus between our 7 Supreme Court justices.
Oh, yeah. They don't get along very well. I think somebody, Patrick Marley, tweeted this week about watching Supreme Court. It's like watching a Thanksgiving dinner. It's kind of tense mm-hmm. sometimes, family. A lot of tension there.
Yeah.
Justice Rogensack does not like the court's integrity being questioned by anybody. She gave a speech, was a month or so ago.
At Marquette.
Really went after one former justice for questioning the court's integrity. She's very sensitive to that and does not care for criticism, especially from Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice Abramson, because they've gone at it left and right the last couple of years.
And 1 week from today, Chief Justice Rogensack will be sitting in that chair for a newsmaker's interview. And it was just interesting the way Shirley Abramson, her final comment at this week's administrative meeting, she said, we may need a therapy session, but that's not for me to say.
And Rogensack has made the point in that comment, that speech was, if you keep running the court down, that makes it seem less credible to the public, and stop doing that, it'll help our perception.
Right. Okay. New subject. Wisconsin and I conducted a civil dialogue with Speaker Voss and Democratic Leader Barca, in which both said two things that I was kind of surprised that they don't agree on much, JR, but they did agree. They don't like the governor's 5% UW system tuition cut, and they're no fans of the governor's self-insurance plan. So let's listen to just about a minute and a half of their exchange on those issues just this week. Neither one of you then supports the governor's 5% tuition lower in the second year of the biennium, the 18-19 school year, correct? I just want to be sure.
Well, I don't.
Okay, Peter.
Well, and I would only support it if it's fully funded. But obviously, for both university funding and for K-12 funding, it's dependent on the self-insurance being implemented and working.
And if you pull that out, it all collapses.
Right. Now, first of all, self-insurance, I would describe in one word, is a risky proposition. Because Deloitte and Touche, when they did an objective study, they found out there's just as much chance we could lose $100 million.
I trust Chairman Nygren. I know he has been working on ways to find similar savings, maybe not quite the same. So that's why I think there's some flexibility in the number, as opposed to just saying, no, we're going to stick with it no matter what, and then have to cut somebody else to be able to fund it. I think this is an area, again, where Peter and I agree. I don't support the tuition cut. I think our tuition in the university system is a very good bargain. Perhaps if we don't do the tuition cut, which is about $30-35 million, we would use that same dollar to be able to fill in the raises so the university is kept whole, because I certainly think people who work for the university system deserve a raise as much as a prison guard.
The problem is that after the governor took $250 million out of the university system the last couple of years, I just don't know where the money's going to come from to be able to actually do that, because he certainly isn't making up the difference in this budget. So as a consequence, I think we may be forced that the only solution is to put it into need-based, you know, financial assistance.
Okay, JR, no, let's talk about the self-insurance plan. The governor's budget scores it at $60 million upper. And Peter Barker said, you know, a consultant X number of years ago said it could lose. But the governor's budget says, I'm going to take $30 million of that 60, and that'll be the difference between a per pupil aid of 188 per pupil upper and 200. Mm-hmm. So now when Speaker Voss talks about, well, we're going to be close to the governor on K-12 aids, the 649, we may not get there if we don't get any savings from the self-insurance plan, which neither of them like.
Yeah.
So let's talk about self-insurance plan first. DOA?
Depends. I don't think that lawmakers on both sides like it, especially in the Finance Committee. The question becomes, can they find other ways to save in the state employee health insurance program? Could they increase deductibles, co-pays, these kinds of things and find similar savings? That might be one option. But Nygren, co-chair, who's in the insurance industry, is not like this from day one. He's expressed various levels of opposition to it or concern about it. The concern is that we've done this before. This came up previously that we've done this before. It didn't work out so well back in the early 80s, I think it was. Cost us more than we thought it would, so why bring it back now 30 years later? Alberta Darling, the other co-chair, talked to her. She's not a big fan. But again, can they find savings elsewhere to kind of keep what we have for now, maybe, but do it a different way?
When the governor announced his budget on February 8th, he thought he had a winner in a 5% tuition cut for resident undergrad, but not starting it until 18-19, the second year of the biennium. But now you have Barca, Dem, Voss, Republicans saying ain't going to happen. And maybe we'll take the $35 million that the governor had budgeted to offset that 5% tuition cut, and we'll use that to give UW employees a pay raise. So also dead?
I've not gotten the impression that many folks are big fans of that, because Voss has said for pretty much the day it was announced, he'd rather put that money into financial aid or somewhere
Mark
else.
Mark has said that in the clip, yeah.
The $35 million is sitting there. So if they look around ways to, if they don't want to do self-insurance, got to find other pots of money. There's $20 million bucks that Governor Walker wants put in the rain day fund. You could grab that. You could grab the $35 million for the tuition cut and either pay for the UW employee raises and offset that lost money from the self-insurance model. I mean, there's ways to make this work if you move money around.
Yeah, I think I took a lead from one of your Wisconsin Politics stories, and I asked Voss, so Assembly Republicans are building a transportation package. And Voss said yes, and he's pretty much said it's going to include a revenue upper. But the governor has said ixnay to revenue uppers.
Well, his language has changed a little bit last week.
This is the governor's language.
Yes.
Thank you.
He's still on the no gas tax hike kick. WTMJ Radio has Insight 2017 had this week.
Yes.
The governor says open work with Dale Kayenga, who's a member of the Joint Finance Committee, Republican from Brookfield in the Assembly.
Putting together a tax package.
Leadership in the Assembly GOP released this kind of outline a couple months back. It said we're going to cut taxes $300 million to pave the way to increase revenue for transportation. Now, they never say how it's going to do it. It would be gas tax, hike, or registration, whatever. But they said we're going to do this. Governor Walker said, no, they're now the time to raise gas tax, period. In 2015, Governor Walker, then running for president, said, I consider a registration fee increase a gas tax hike. So he's been saying all along, you know, no hike in the gas tax or registration fee without an offsetting tax cut somewhere else. Republicans thought they met that standard with this package. Governor Walker saying, no, now's the time to raise taxes. But this week he's saying, well, I'm open to working with Dale about, you know, finding some new solutions. Then today I saw a story, I didn't hear it from him, but I saw a story saying that he said no to the gas tax hike still, but maybe, you know, there's a way to do some kind of other transportation-related fees as part of a solution. Those aren't off the table. But again, we don't know the details of what King is going to propose as part of this kind of like linchpin of the budget, because I've talked to both co-chairs this week and they said transportation is the number one fight on the budget. How are we going to solve it? We need a long-term solution. How are they going to find more money? And the governor's saying no gas tax increase. So.
And my takeaway from Speaker Voss when I interviewed him on Civil Dialogue is we're going to come out with a package. It's going to have a revenue upper. Mm-hmm. We're going to try to sell it publicly before we take it to joint finance. In other words, there's going to be a lot of roadshow support for, they hope, for the Assembly Republican package before they take it. And by the way, joint finance starts voting May 1?
Tentative date May 1 for the first votes. But these revenue enhancements, you know, somebody told me the other day, think back to the Bucks arena when we were all fixated on like raising tax or having it, you know, directing income tax from the state to do this, and they found an alternative method of funding that arena. It didn't end up being a Miller Park type sales tax. We all thought maybe that was going to be part of the solution. They found something different. Keep your open mind, this transportation solution being something outside what you expect. Maybe they can find, you know, some money off a registration fee increase. Maybe they can find other taxes that are, you could argue, obsolete and move that money over. Maybe they can redirect money from elsewhere. There's pots of money everywhere in the budget.
There is.
Can they find ways to do this that make it work? That's the thing to watch
the
for.
Income tax cut, $203 million, mm-hmm. and taking the state-levied forestry property tax, that's $188. So those are those pockets of money you're talking about?
Well, you never know, because Republicans could argue, some Republicans could argue, that Walker gave them the first steps toward their package of $300 million in tax cuts by doing those things. Well, you've already cut taxes this much. Let's add some more, and then, hey, we've got the... So we'll see. Keep an open mind on what they do. It might not be what we... When I say open mind of... It's not what we expect, like a straight gas tax hike or a straight... Maybe it's something different.
Right.
That's what I'm watching for.
Other subject. President Trump was in Kenosha at Snap-on, and he's worried about Wisconsin dairy farmers. This is this 58 farmers who were notified by Grassland that as of May 1, they're not going to be buying their milk. The president said, we're going to stand up for dairy farmers in Wisconsin because in Canada some very unfair things have happened to our dairy farmers and others. Now, you and I don't know much about this issue, so we're not going to pretend we do. But I got an email yesterday. Apparently about 10 of these farmers have found new markets for their milk. We're going to a dairy farm in Beaver Dam on Monday to talk to one of those affected. But he also talked about, he signed the order, I want to find new restrictions on, I want to get the term right, H-1B visas. But these visas are used by Wisconsin manufacturers. Mm-hmm. We're number one, two, or three in manufacturing. So your thoughts on the president's visit?
Some business leaders weren't very happy with the rhetoric on those visas because they're sometimes high-demand jobs or high-tech jobs. The argument, though, is we should be filling those Americans. This is part of the Trump rhetoric we've seen from the campaign trail. Also interesting, he signed the Buy American executive order this week. He's coming back to Wisconsin in part because, one, it's the home of Reince Priebus, the chief of staff. Two, it's the home district of Paul Ryan, though Ryan wasn't there. Three, he won Wisconsin last fall by
22,000 votes.
Keep the home fires burning there.
Yeah.
You know, keep planting a flag. Hits the Milwaukee market and Chicago. So the reason to come back to Wisconsin inside this, he's still trying to keep the pockets where he did well, or at least surprise people last fall. Keep the home fires burning there a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. And he was at Snap-on. I want to talk about one of the most emotional bills in the Capitol. It's an issue that never goes away. Mm-hmm. You and I have been covering it for, let's say, decades. The new bill by Senator Craig, and who's a co-sponsor in the Assembly? You remember?
Drawing blank right now.
Okay. Would prohibit state-bought health care plans.
Oh, from Andre Jacques.
Andre Jacques. Thank you very much. Oh, so Senator Craig and Representative Jacques, their bill would say state purchased health care plans could not pay for abortions. Senator Craig, this bill isn't saying you can't have abortions done. What this bill is saying is that state taxpayers shouldn't pay for it. And Representative Chris Taylor of Milwaukee, Democrat, leave these decisions to the physicians and families who are suffering, and they are suffering when they have a wanted pregnancy that goes wrong. Is this the issue that Senator Erpenbach warned all hell will break loose if this comes to the Senate floor? Is this the one?
I'm not sure if it's this one, but this is a continuation of the kind of rhetoric on abortion in the Capitol. Remember, Governor Walker signed a ban on abortion for 20 weeks in 2015, again, while he's looking at running for president. There's been a gradual chipping away at access, or, you know, there was the bill on admitting privileges for hospitals for clinics that perform abortions that was struck down by the federal courts.
Yep.
Waiting periods, ultrasounds. I mean, their Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, said here's kind of like a bright line, and we've seen lots of states, including Wisconsin now, finding ways around that line, or how far can we go in the light of that line, what's going to be allowed. And they've been successful with these things. You have a very much an anti-abortion legislature and governor with Scott Walker, and they are open to restrictions. Now, the governor, I'm not sure if he's open to this particular bill or enthused about the idea of taking this on right now. He's trying to focus on the good news in his budget of K-12 education, our funding, these kinds of things. But this is an issue percolating along with, you know, fetal tissue and research and all these other kind of issues that are out there.
Yeah, right. And as part of this debate, I'm intrigued. The Department of Health Services publishes an annual estimate of the number of induced abortions. So I'm not arguing for either side. I just think these stats are pretty interesting. And if you go back just 15 years, the number of induced abortions in Wisconsin has dropped by 48%. And from 11,000 to 5,660 in 2015, the last year that we have available. And just one more footnote, the highest number of induced abortions was 21,000 in 1980. So you have seen a tremendous decrease. Again, I'm not arguing one side or the other. I just think numbers like this add context to this issue. Okay, new subject. The Republicans now are coming out with limits on school referendums. Now, you and I have talked about this, but when I look at the numbers between January of 2016 and April 4 of this year, bonding building referendums, $1.8 billion. Source on that is the Wisconsin Taxpayer Alliance, 0.1, 0.2. Since 1994, when you got into the revenue limits, 250 school districts, or 59% of all districts, have voted to exceed the levy limits, even though it may have been for, you know, only 2 or 3 years. So I'm not saying 250 are outside of them now. So your thoughts on whether the Republicans limits on the school referendums are a real serious item that are going to get considered?
I believe I saw Governor Walker say that he has opened the idea of limiting these referendums to the general election elections, which are April and November. Didn't seem very excited about the idea of if you exceed referendum or if you exceed your caps, you then get penalized by losing state aid, which is one of the ideas in this package. So mixed bag right now for what their prospects are, but I think the idea of when you can hold these referendums might be something that gets some traction.
Yeah, let's just take a quick look at what the Republicans, led by Senator Strobel, are pushing. As you said, you couldn't. The referendums must coincide with the spring or fall primary or general election, statewide election. And then this is interesting, as you said, if voters permit exceeding revenue limits, offset state aid. So if they allow you to go up by $5 million, to use the Journal Sentinel's example, you could lose 20% of that. A real pinch. Let districts exceed revenue caps, not forever and ever, amen, but only for 5 years. And referendums could only be scheduled at regular or annual board meetings. There's also one more provision. Taxpayers would have to know the cost of paying off this bond issue over 10 or 20 years. So those are pretty interesting, and I think it's a live issue, right?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Strobel pushed some of the stuff last session very far, so he's back again this session with it.
Okay, my fun issue for this one is personal delivery devices. these things are coolers, JR, and they can weigh 80 pounds without the cargo, and it got a public hearing, and there's wonderful photos there. Though they have to weigh less than 80 pounds, excluding the cargo. They can only be on sidewalks and crosswalks. They cannot go faster than 10 miles per hour. You must obey the traffic signals. The operator must control or monitor these devices. Now, does the operator, do you know, do they have to stay with them? Within a proximity?
I don't know.
This is a fun issue, though.
Hey, Amazon looking at using drones, right? Or whatever to deliver stuff, so.
Right. And they must have braking system ID and at night a white light reflector at night. Okay, so we can order carry-out food. We can order groceries.
Is there a 12-pack?
That's my question. Do you think we can get a Liney's 12-pack this way?
Maybe.
Maybe? It's just a fun issue. But this has not yet been approved for a vote. But these personal delivery devices
It's changing technology. It's a different. The drones, these, it's a different world than what we're living in before, and they're trying to catch up with some of these advances in technology.
Yeah, and they're being used in Washington, D.C., which I just find fascinating. Okay, time for your stock picks, sir.
So Scott Walker, Democrats have a perception problem. The perception is that they want to make this argument that Scott Walker's vulnerable, that it's going to be a bad year in 2018 for Republicans because of Donald Trump. But as long as Dems keep passing and running against Scott Walker, they have this. They feed the perception that Scott Walker is in a strong position and nobody wants to take him on. Now, last one was Joe Parisi, Dane County Executive. I'm going to be honest with you. When I talked to operatives from the Democratic side of the aisle the last few months, they were not very excited about the Joe Parisi candidacy for a couple reasons. Dane County liberal, They need somebody from outside, outstate, to communicate with rural voters, right? That's not really in Joe's wheelhouse. Doesn't have a reputation as a big fundraiser, you know? So you need somebody like that to take on Walker. So he wasn't, in their minds, a top-tier candidate. The problem is, without anybody else in the race, he is top-tier. So it feeds in the perception again of top-tier candidates declining running against Scott Walker. So who's left? Well, a 25-year-old kid ran for Congress in California. Yeah. He's not really taken seriously by anybody. Dana Walks, state lawmaker from Eau Claire.
Now, when he came in to get Matt at the Supreme Court, he was asked by the State Journal, Matt, look, are you running? Are you thinking about seriously running for governor? And he said, my family and I, yes, I am. Bottom line,
yeah.
I'm seriously thinking, Dana Walks, I'm seriously thinking about running for governor. Go ahead with your list. Susan Happ,
Kathleen Weinhout.
There's Andy Gronick,
who had some problems this week.
Yes.
He paid for a poll. Apparently, we're not sure how he paid for it. That asks about Wisconsinians, which I don't know any cheesehead who would talk about Wisconsinians, but
that's the kind of thing that resonates with an opponent.
That's the
Wisconsinians?
Inference,
I don't think so.
The inference to insider to talk to you is either you're getting help from somebody out of state or no help at all. So that's not a good sign.
Did we mention Susan Happ?
Yes. And okay. So there are other names keep floating, but nobody stepped forward and said, I'm going to be in. Now, Democrats say, look, in 2013, Mary Burke's name didn't really start circulating until like summer. It announced until October. Once we get somebody in who's going to run, this will all go away because we'll have a candidate. Republicans will keep saying, look, until they have a candidate, keep showing they have a problem.
Yeah.
There's a thin bench, and they don't have to be strong as Scott Walker. And you run the risk, if you're a Democrat, that Scott Walker running for a third term, which is always difficult, in a possibly bad environment, may get a better prospect of winning re-election because he doesn't have a strong opponent.
And my civil dialogue, my last question went to Peter Barca. 8 Democrats have said no. When are you going to announce? And he said no. So he's number 9 out of it. Okay, mixed.
Julie Lassa. It is
former
not,
Democratic state senator.
It is
Point.
Not uncommon for a former lawmaker to become a lobbyist. What is not common is when the majority leader of the Senate says this was maybe the dumbest hire I've seen in 20 years legislature, and hopes the employer fires the person.
Now, she was picked up by
Century Insurance. Here's the deal. Julie Lassa was a member of the legislature for almost 18 years. She represented the Assembly for a couple terms, won the Senate seat in 2003, I think it was, lost this fall to Pat Testin in kind of the Trump wave. Century's one of the biggest employers in her district. We got a tip about this, that they'd hired her. Finally confirmed it this week that, yes, we hired Julie. She's going to work with Midwestern states. Fitzgerald was not happy about this. He calls it an affront to both him and to Pat Testin, who beat Julie Lassa. Because here you have somebody who was a Democrat who was, in his mind, throwing bombs at Republicans up until like last fall when she left to go run for election. Now supposed to work with her? How is she going to be an advocate in their offices? Two, you think about it, lobbyists often get these like briefings on campaign strategy, on targeted races. How is Fitzgerald going to feel about having a former Democratic lawmaker come into these private meetings and share strategy? The company says, hey, she is a homegrown talent, really happy to have her. And Jennifer Schilling, the minority leader, says, what's going on with Fitzgerald and Testin? They're being over-emotional. Who else have they blackmailed, Republicans, about who they hire and what they do? This is not right over the top. It's kind of a capital insider drama mess, but it's interesting.
But you're right that a legislative leader, if they don't like a particular lobbyist, they're going to send a message, look, don't have this lobbyist try to make an appointment with me. It's not going to happen. But that's done privately. And for Fitz to erupt publicly is very unusual.
And lobbyists I talked to said, look, this is a head-scratcher to them because if you're usually, when you hire a former lawmaker, you pick one from the majority party who's going to have better access to their former colleagues because they're like-minded. But this is kind of an odd one.
It is. Okay, falling.
So DHS had to pay a $7 million fine to the feds. This goes back to a little bit of the Dole administration in the first year, I think, of the Walker administration. But they made mistakes or didn't properly report errors in the food stamps program. If you don't have errors, you get bonuses. We got bonuses you shouldn't have gotten, had to pay it back. A little bit of a ding. So $7 million doesn't feel very good for the state to pay that up.
That's a good call. Speaker Voss did announce in that civil dialogue the Assembly is going to debate the high-capacity well bill that the Senate passed on May 2nd. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we're just a couple of Wisconsinians. That's Rewind for April 21st.
Rewind, Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.